Welcome to the Nevermore Podcast. The Nevermore Podcast is created by the Three Little Sisters, an independent publisher, with titles for you. All month long in February, we were giving away a whole bunch of ebooks, and in March coming up, we're going to do something even more awesome. In March, we're actually going to be featuring all the ladies of TLS, which there are quite a number of. So every day over the month of March, you're going to see some spotlights onto the female authors that we have within our house, some little tidbits on what they are working on, and a surprise freebie from Samantha Norcia, who is going to be releasing her book Hellscape. So we're really excited about all this stuff that's coming out, and we encourage you to go grab some books, because now is the time to start getting some deals. So as we talk about women in literature, this is a good time to make the podcast about women in literature. So today we're going to be discussing the history of women's literature and the importance that it plays for all of us in writing. The history of women's literature is kind of extensive. Not only is there historical precedent for women's writings throughout different styles of writing, for example, there's a fair number of religious canons that were written by women, including household manuals, including poetry, including a lot of things. So we're going to go through all of that and hopefully, hit on all of our points. So we're going to start off by sort of discussing what we feel is the importance of women's literature. So interestingly, in doing some research, I found out that the catalog of women, which dates back to somewhere around the early stages of Greece, it basically discusses in here a fragment of a Greek poem where women were in fact heroines, many of whom laid with the gods in Greek mythology. And from here, inside the poem, it actually details how women were considered to be the first of the writers, being that women in general, and I'm being very general here, were referred to as where sort of inspiration kind of comes from. And so therefore, all women were sort of considered to be divinely inspired and therefore would be creative. So that's where we get like the first marking of when women were considered to be part of the writing genre, sort of. But as we dive into this history, we'll kind of skip ahead a lot because we can't go through every point in history. But it's interesting to know where we sort of come from, you know, and where we sort of been going. I'm going to head off this topic by asking my two fellow podcasters, Sarah and Shiel, who will always be on these episodes. So I feel like introducing us over and over again is kind of getting old, but it's always going to be the three of us because there are three little sisters. So what do you guys think is the real key importance of women's literature that we can sort of take away when you look at history sort of overarching?
Shiel, do you want to start off?
Well, I think gender gap is the biggest one. Because women authors will touch on things like birth in apocalyptic times or birth control, or, you know, they touch on the women's issues that men don't generally touch on when they write things like apocalyptic science fiction, or, you know, even look at Handmaid's Tale. It touches on the women's point of view and basically birthrights.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I think part of the importance of it is just having that kind of a view of life through a woman's eyes. You see that perspective on various topics from family, from love, from politics, religion, everything. You know, women do view these things differently, and it's interesting to see that in women's literature.
And take, for example, even a TV show, Walking Dead. The only time they touched on women's issues in a post-apocalyptic world was when Laura gave birth.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. They never touched on it afterwards. Maybe touching on the fact that, you know, mother loses child of several times, Carol, and even, child losing mother, but they never touch on anything like birth control, birthing, midwives, medical birth compared to home birth. They don't touch on any of those female issues that you would normally see, well, that you would see in a post-apocalyptic world if it were real. Right. Men don't do that. They take, dude is the superhero of the post-apocalyptic story, and he wins. That's it. Doesn't touch on anything else. Doesn't mm-hmm. have to. And it's not the man writer's fault or the male writer's fault. It's just that they don't understand those concepts or issues because they are not a woman.
Yeah, I would agree with both of you. And it's fascinating to look at women's contribution to literature overall, because when you think about it, there probably is quite an extensive history of women in writing, a lot of it not very well known, and mostly because of the fact that women were kept fairly illiterate. They were allowed to learn and were allowed to write and things like that, but only if you were wealthy or in the upper class. Very often girls didn't or weren't seen as needing to know how to do anything, maybe simple math, and that's about it. So there is likely a long history of where women were contributing, but it was sort of, you know, kind of brushed aside. And so I think it's important when you look back historically in today's lens to say that, you know, now that we have a lot of more secured female writers, that you can see the lens of history looking backwards in a much different way. It's giving us a much broader sense of the past, present, and future, because you have women looking at it from various points of view. So I think it's really cool to see how women, you know, kind of adapted themselves and moved through the annals of history to kind of make their place in literature today. And I would say that I agree with what you both are saying about they kind of touch on things that are only signaturely in the hands of women, like childbirth, like birth control, matters of the home, matters of the heart. These are all very women-centered things. Not that men can't experience love or write love poetry. There has been fantastic poetry written by men. Mm-hmm. But women speak from a very unique place, and I think it's important to hear what they have to say. In fact, kind of interestingly, when I was doing research for this podcast, I came across the first instance of a woman actually being published. And this is a book called The Female Advocate, a poem occasioned by reading by Mr. Duncombe's Feminade. And it was actually written by a Miss Scott. And she actually had to go under this guy to get published, which is kind of interesting. And she wrote this poem that basically advocated for women in writing. And she wrote why is it that women are considered to be so demure, like their words matter. And she just goes on and on and on in this poem. And it's actually kind of fascinating. So I will definitely post this for people to read. The poem is very old school, right? A lot of thighs and this. But she touches on a lot of things in this poem about how women have been kind of undermined in writing. And she talks and advocates for them being lifted up, basically, because she says that in the poem that are not women, you know, speaking from a good place, like speaking. Well, she refers to it as like speaking as the voice that God thou givest me. So she's saying like, I'm speaking with my voice. And it's very interesting little poem to read. And that this is the first actual historical example of a woman's voice being actually published in a book format. So it's kind of interesting to look at how it all began. So I just kind of found that kind of fascinating. It's also interesting to note like how women kind of contributed to a lot of religious lore. I'm sure that Shiel, being formerly Catholic, can attribute to the fact that a lot of the canons of religious history are actually written by nuns. And this was mostly because, again, like looking back on how people were taught, girls were only taught to read and write the Bible. And so you get a lot of introspection on Mary specifically from women. And there's hundreds and hundreds of articles written about the Virgin Mary from the perspective of women. And it's actually kind of fascinating to read. So if anybody wants to dive into the periodicals and religious canons, I have hundreds of thousands of links that I'm going to be posting after this article for this organization called the Haight Foundation, H-A-I-T. And they actually specialize in documenting women's history throughout religious canon. So it shows each and every instance in which women contributed to that lore. So it's kind of really fascinating to look at how much they actually did. So when we talk about women in writing, you know, a lot of the times they seem to be relegated to very unique genres, like we've all been stating. So let's discuss what we think our female, our favorite female author is and why we think that. So if you, one of you guys want to start off, go ahead.
I'll let Sarah start because I really honestly don't have a favorite female author.
I have a couple. Diana Gabaldon, who wrote Outlander. I really like her style of writing and how she is able to write very delicate subject matter, but in a way that's almost, I don't know, like an outside perspective. It's really cool how she can distance herself from those and just kind of write the facts. Another one is Melanie Ron, who is a fantasy author. And she's written a lot of really beautiful, beautiful stories. Same with Anne Bishop, who's also a fantasy writer. She wrote the Blood Jewels trilogy and a couple others that are really good.
I guess if I had to pick a few of them, and I do have a few that I do like, I just don't know if I have a favorite per se. Definitely Mary Shelley for inventing sci-fi genre with her Frankenstein. But Anne Rice and Nancy Collins for their vampire lore and well-written types of vampire stories. They are like the grandmothers of, and I bet you both of them wouldn't like being called grandmothers at this point because they're not old enough to be, but they are literally the cornerstone of female written vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a few favorites as well. I really like Anne Rice too because I like vampire novels. I really have a hard time reading the classic books like by, you know, Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen. The language kind of gets muddled in my brain. But I really enjoy, in modern novels, Catherine Stockett's The Help. I really loved that novel. I thought it was amazing. I thought the book kind of matched the movie a lot in many ways, but the book was substantially better. And I also fell in love with this poet author called Amanda Lovelace, who totally speaks to the way I'm feeling in life right now. She wrote these series of books that are all basically dealing with her, basically therapeutically dealing with abuse. One of them is called To Drink Coffee with a Ghost. And in it, she details her experience losing her mama. And I can totally relate to her because I lost my mom too. And reading this book was like opening wounds, but it was really beautiful. And I totally felt everything that she felt. It was really interesting. Like one of the favorite poems I bookmarked actually, and I have it sort of written out to put on my wall. It says, "In all the history of the world, no one has ever been able to teach others how to fill the hole a dead parent leaves." And so I really found like the book kind of spoke to me, and I've picked up her other ones just because this one kind of like really hit home. So for me, that's currently my favorite is Amanda Lovelace. So big props to her for helping me deal with some really hard things that I've been dealing with, because it's a really amazing book. And people who've lost, you know, parents or family members in life or who are recovering from abuse, I would definitely recommend reading it. It definitely makes you go through a lot of things. And it's a good thing. It's like definitely a very therapeutic book. So that's my favorite. All right, so moving on here, because we sort of discussed classical women's literature, but I kind of want to circle back on that and kind of discuss the weird genre of classical writing in the wonderful and misleading household manuals. So there's a huge history of women writing household manuals, the famous of which is Mrs. Beatwood. She has a glorious household manual that everyone should read just for the absolute amusement of it. But what do you think about the fact that most of women's history, outside of the few authors that kind of deviated from this, why do you think women were so, or could make their mark in writing household manuals? Like, what do you think it was about other women that would be like, oh, wow, this is, like, amazing?
That has a lot to do with, again, there's that gender gap and gender roles, depending on what point in time in the history you're talking about, too. Back in the 50s, the gender roles were pretty established. Woman at home, taking care of the house, taking care of the kids. Man at work, bringing in the bacon. So other women who were writing these manuals were writing them for women specifically. So whoever made a name for themselves in writing these manuals were the authoritarian voice on how to keep your home, how to raise your children, how to keep your husband happy.
Yeah, and for people who didn't have, you know, for women who might not have had a very ingrained maternal instinct, or even a, you know, ingrained, I don't want to say like wife instinct, but like housekeeping and things like that, you know, these books were probably lifesavers for them because, you know, they didn't naturally know how to do all these things. They weren't, or maybe they weren't taught how to do any of this. So, you know, this was sort of their way to stay secure.
Yeah, and interestingly, you guys bring up some really valid points there. Interestingly, and I have to dig up the name because I can't remember which specialist did this series through the BBC, but there was a series that was done about sort of the history of indentured servants, and she went through like why servants started writing books about household care. So most of the household manuals that you have historically come from indentured servants or the servant class because they were the ones that were cleaning. Mm-hmm. When Britain had this huge boom in the Victorian era, when the middle class emerged, middle class women actually had no idea how to take care of a house. They had never had stoves before or had to make tea before or any of this stuff. And you had this middle class that was flush with cash, and they wanted to do what the grand houses did. So they wanted to have luncheons and things like that. Actually, funny enough, this there's a series by one of the two fat ladies, Clarissa Clark, I think is her last name. And she did the history of breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And she actually touches on this because in Bronte's books, she mentions cooking. Like Jane Austen and Emily Bronte both documented how people ate inside their novels. And through that, they figured out how people actually would come up with recipes. So there were recipe books that were ingrained inside fiction as well, because of the fact that the middle class, like Bronte and Eyre would have been middle class, were kind of like trying to adapt what happened in these grand houses into their little tiny homes. So a lot of the household manuals came from people that had to figure out how to manage and budget a very wealthy person's home. It was actually not that easy because supplies to get, you know, cleaning things and whatnot were very, very expensive. So servants who were responsible for like house maintenance would figure out ways of like reducing the cost. And when you had these household manuals that were written, it was mostly about penny pinching. Like, how can you get the most out of a stew and like using the bare scraps of your table to like produce food. So it was really helpful to women of the middle class to have these books because they didn't know how to like feed a family of 27 or have parties. They didn't know how to do that. So these books really were an invaluable resource to them to figure out how to save some money, how to use all of the parts of their animals, and how to actually like put on a show so that they could have, you know, this seemingly very rich existence on a very poor man's budget. It was just basically like how to fake it, how to fake your Victorian tea party, how to fake your dinner party. And a lot of the food that they have discovered at the time through these household manuals sounds absolutely like I would not eat it. A lot of it was like Jell-O molds and like weird, you know, it just parts very animals bizarre. That you
would not normally want to eat.
Yeah, a lot of snouts and things like that, you know, because it was, they were poor. So it's very interesting when you think about the household manuals in that context, and I'll see if I can find what that series was, but she really documented that, like, a lot of these manuals were written by house servants who just couldn't, they needed to stretch the budget. Like, how do you make that soap last? How do you blacken boots when you don't have blackening powder? How do you make sure that your maids are not stealing, you know, your brooches and things like that? Like, housekeepers had to be on it because they were running the house. And so women needed to learn from them, and it's very useful. So it's really interesting when you look at the history of that. Shiel, do you have any thoughts on like the creation of like sort of household manuals? I know you said it was, you know, depending on the time period, it was, you know, just speaking to that specific subset of people who would need it. But do you have any other thoughts on like why it is it seems like most of history only refers to like, oh, women's literature was household manuals. Forget all these other like side things that they did.
A lot of that, I think, again, has to do with the gender gap, right? And what the possible causes of gender gap are. I mean, today, neuroscientists find that women have a greater capacity for empathy, a trait that connects them more instinctively to characters and motives in fiction and nonfiction, for that matter, if we're going to talk about the household manuals. So they make bigger connections, more emotional connections to what they're reading. They also can sit for longer periods than boys, apparently, and that's a behavior that influences sustainable reading habits, which means that they're going to take in more than, say, the male counterpart. And on top of that, it's community. Women prefer to have hubs of community between themselves. They've always been a group self-support kind of gender.
Yeah,
I also think it's interesting to note from a pagan perspective, you know, a lot of these household journals and house books had a lot of, you know, depending on how far back you went, had a lot of herbal remedies and, you know, folk magic and stuff like that, that was sort of woven into them. So it's interesting to go back and look at them and say, okay, this is how they treated colds, or this is how they treated a fever. This is what herbs they used to treat a fever or to stop bleeding. And it's really interesting.
And on top of that, despite gender, sharing of information has always been a very human trait.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and traditionally, even though women were considered to be not really the storytellers, that might not be very true. Because like Sarah says, there's like a lot of herbal lore woven into household manuals. And even beyond that, there's even some in women's, quote, medicine, because we have some historical examples of midwife books that are chocked full of like herbal remedies. This is where we get the idea that chamomile brings on a woman's cycle, because chamomile was documented in midwife books as helping women through producing that time of the month for them. Mm-hmm. So we know these herbal things because it has been documented by women. Men did not know of these types of remedies. They wouldn't have been involved in women's care. Like, I think there's some, you know, misunderstanding with how history sort of evolved, but women were really with other women like 90% of the time.
Yeah.
Yes, they were with men, but there were clusters of women that would practice together religiously, practice together, you know, economically. They would be together, travel together, discuss things together. Like, there was a huge group of women that shared knowledge between each other. That's where you get these herbal remedies and things like that, and what they call like folk magic or women's magic or women's, you know, like, you know, the mother's remedies, like, oh, mama always knows you have a fever by kissing your forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the events sound like weird superstitions or like that's just a weird, you know, folky housewife thingy. But really, most of the time, it's proven out to be very true. And oddly, now we see a lot more remedies being produced that women were talking about for decades, like drinking apple cider vinegar, having a tablespoon of that, or castor oil, which you should be very careful using, and other remedies that help, you know, women in our bodily functions, but are now being recognized as actually legitimate. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how it kind of evolved that way. And you guys are right. Like, a lot of it comes from just the gender gap that you had decades and decades and decades of, well, girls aren't supposed to do that sort of stuff. You're supposed to go home and have kids, and that's what you're supposed to do, and there isn't very much else for you to do. So I think that there's some interesting, you know, overlap where we're seeing today this rise of women writers, and it's a good thing because now we can look back, they can look back sort of reflectively on society and be like, well, it would have been nice if we had women sort of dedicating themselves to this or like chiming in, like especially as Sarah and I know as heathen women, especially when it comes to mythology. Like, hearing from the women who are focusing on heathen studies, this is really beneficial for us because we can see differences in how those myths are being interpreted. And it's really helpful. I think it just adds things to our human existence that are really, really vital to add. Mm-hmm. So, interestingly, and there's going to be kind of an overlap between this podcast and our next one, which is about animals in literature. Women actually wrote a huge amount of children's literature, and that's really interesting to me as well. So it seems like women were also focused on the education of children and also focused on sort of creating fun narratives. There's actually a whole book called With Love from Your Pussycat that was written by a woman, and it's all these letters that were written from her cat as her cat is wandering about the world. It actually might be like a precursor to Puss in Boots. But she wrote, and the story and the letters in there are absolutely ridiculous. Like, some of them are like, "Dear Madam, I am at," like that's how they start. Like, each of the letters are written from this cat. And so what do you guys think? Why do you think women sort of garnered in children's literature? I mean, I know we have a lot of men that helped in that area, like Lewis Carroll and others like that, but women seem to be focused on a lot on children's education. Do you think that also plays into the gender gap?
Oh, it most definitely plays into the gender gap, because us women, again, are seen as more capable of more empathy. We're also the childbearing gender, so we have that biological connection to children and children's lit.
And, you know, childcare was seen as sort of strictly the realm of the woman, so we would naturally have been looking for ways to educate them, to teach them morals, which, you know, if you look at a lot of like the old fables, you know, those are all moral stories, but they're written in ways that children would be able to identify with them. So I think it's, you know, just kind of natural that children's literature would have been an area where the women really would have flourished.
I agree. And I also think it helped them, you know, sort of connect with their children. Like, when you look at the Victorian era, a lot of the times children were kept separate from their parents because of the fact that women weren't supposed to really be doing anything. In fact, I often wonder to myself when I think about history that women must have been exceptionally bored in that time, mm-hmm. because they were relegated to sitting in parlors and embroidering and talking to other women. And I mean, eventually you'd probably run out of things to say. And, they weren't allowed to spend time with their children. That was responsibility delegated to the nanny. So I often wonder if a lot of these books were ways for them to, you know, sort of put placers in the loss of not having those children around. And perhaps some of those women did sit down at night and read their children's stories as a way of connecting to them, to feel that they were still their mother. As I'm sure it was exceptionally difficult to be distanced from your child like that. So, you know, I often think about that when it comes to children's literature that was written by women, if it was a tool for them to stay connected to their children.
And what's interesting is when I was doing some research on this, it the Victorian era is really where we see women authors kind of struggling with that role of, you know, you stay home and you tend the children and you have a very rigid set of standards. You know, there were a lot of female authors who just really pushed the boundaries on that and said, no, this is not how we want to live. They were still confined to a certain kind of language. They couldn't really be like 100% full feminist, but they definitely started to push the envelope a little bit and say, you know, women exist. We should be able to do things and kind of be more involved in society.
I 100% agree with you. And I think that you made excellent points, and there isn't much more to say than that. I think that it's a lot to, is a lot to pay homage to, and a lot of women paved the way for us to be here. And, you know, very thankful that they did, because I don't think we would have had the opportunity to write if they didn't fight for women to kind of break through. And it's just fascinating when you think about the historical, you know, throwbacks. So some of the things that you guys brought up here that I'm sort of reading through is that Shiel brought up this literary prize winner, Carol Shields. So that's a kind of amazing story. This Canadian author who is the, let me see here. What does she write?
She's actually a dual citizen. She is actually passed on now. But she won the Pulitzer Prize for something called The Stone Diaries. Carol Shields was a woman who was a very prolific genre-spanning author. She wrote more than 20 books. She died in 2003, by the way, from complications of breast cancer. Two particular people, Zawerbni, sorry, I'm killing it there, and Swan decided to create a literary prize specifically for women, non-binary, and trans women. Now, this prize is coming up in 2022 for the very first time, and it's called the Carol Shields Prize. Now, from what I understand is she was passed over for a particular literary prize because she won it. And apparently a male was given it as the second runner-up because women shouldn't win things like that, because they're just not, they're lightweights and unimportant by male critics is the center of that way of thinking. Well, certainly we've turned it around on that and are now looking forward to this particular Carol Shields Prize or literary prize. It's made by women because of a woman, for women, and by non-binary and trans women as well.
That's amazing. And it kind of plays into sort of a topic that we're going to gracefully talk about, because we're not, none of the three of us are trans, so I can't speak from a trans perspective. But what I can say is I'm very encouraged to see how many trans women are coming out and now participating in writing and actually lending themselves, their voice, to an area that kind of matters, because they've been kind of left out. And you brought up too non-binary. It's a new world in which we have to kind of push the boundaries of what has been naturally defined as quote women's literature, and kind of open that definition to include a lot more people. I kind of feel like it goes back to what we were discussing last month about the femme fatale. We've kind of now, we're adding on to the pre-existing notions of what women are and kind of like pushing that boundary out, which I honestly, when you look historically, especially with this topic that we're discussing now, this is what women have been doing from the dawn of time. Like, I hate to say it because it sounds completely sexist, but there isn't any other way to say it. Women have been fighting for their place, and we have always been trying to fight for that place by adding more people into our pool, whether that's gay people or trans people or whatever. We will add whoever we have to add to push and advocate for the best position. And I think that's what we do, at least those of us who are human beings. And there's a lot of people who, like, a lot of women who still dislike or hate trans and LGBTQ. And I'll never understand that, because I just can't hate people. I don't view it that way. I just view that I'm not really defined by anybody's definition of me. So for me to extend my hand to the LGBTQ plus community and trans women is fine.
Well, you know, women's lit is no longer about born woman. It's mm-hmm. about, you know, the new definitions of what gender really is too. Born women have already had a history of fighting for the rights, as you said. Now it's the born women that are standing beside the trans women and the non-binaries and standing with them to say, we've been here already as an actual female, born female. Now we're going to support you as a fellow female and accept you for how you come and who you are. Because you are female to us, whether you're born or not.
I think it's going to be very interesting to see some of these same issues that have been kind of explored in traditional women's literature. I think it's going to be interesting to see that through, you know, a trans woman's eyes or through, you know, their perspective and how they're going to translate that and how they're going to move forward with that. I think that's the most exciting part, is just seeing their perspective.
I absolutely agree with you there, because a trans male to female woman has hormone therapy that they have to deal with. If you reverse it where it's a female to male, they have still their menstruation to deal with, even though they're male. That's a big, huge issue to have to deal with. And it's the same thing for hormonal therapy, is switching from testosterone to estrogen. There's a lot of emotions with that, and vice versa. So it's a struggle that us born women don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be nice to hear about.
I also feel like there is no reason for the hatred. Like, that it still bothers me to that. Like, I'll never understand why people are so like, oh, we can't have trans women, because then you'll have, like, I don't even know what the issue is. To me, it doesn't matter what's between your legs. I couldn't care less. Like, I don't care.
I think
you are who you are. And
I think for a lot of people, it's a fear of change. It's a fear of something that they view as unnatural. There are so many different areas where you can kind of see that influence of, this is quote unquote unnatural, this is quote unquote different, scary, you know, from trans issues, you know, gender issues, everything. There are so many different areas, religion,
culture.
You know, so many different areas where you can really see this imprint of, I'm scared because this is different. I'm scared because this challenges me. And I think
the human species in itself is, as a species, and I'm speaking generally, is absolutely stupid when it comes to the unknown.
Oh,
we
yeah.
just fear it because that's what we biologically maybe or even have been taught to do.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I see it the same way that you guys are seeing it. Like, it is fear. But I think we as women who have struggled to be here and remove some of those strains of patriarchy, can't we understand that how they feel? I mean, they have been crushed by a system that has tried to deliberately erase history of the LGBTQ plus community. Like, history has deliberately tried to erase evidence of gay people, of lesbian people, of trans people. There is history of them existing from the very beginning. So this, you have to understand where they're coming from. Like, women already fought and achieved some fight back, pushback against our erasure. But if we don't see that they're trying to do the same and lift them up when they need it, then I don't understand, like, what was all our fighting for. It wasn't just for our rights.
You still have women that don't think that women should vote. You still have women
that
don't
scary.
Think that, you know, women's health care is important. You have women that don't think that feminism
There was actually
is
an episode on Wife Swap. The clip is on YouTube where there's this woman who believes that all women have their place in the kitchen.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there looking at that going, oh, you would not like living in my household, woman.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish that all of these people would read the early text by this lady named Wollstonecraft. She actually wrote the manual, The Rights for Women. And in there, she writes this paragraph that I think really kind of sums up what we're trying to say to people here. But she says, tyrants of every kind, from weak king to weak father of the family, use this same argument. That is it there. It is in your own best interest. They are all eager to crush reason. But they always say that they usurp reason's throne only for it to be useful. It isn't what you are doing when you force all women by denying them civil and political rights to remain walled in by their families and groping in the dark. Surely, sir, you wouldn't say that duty can be binding without being founded on reason. Arguments for civil and political rights can be drawn from reason, and with splendid support, the more understanding women acquire, the more they will be attached to their duty, understanding it. Unless they understand it, unless their morals are based on the same immutable principles of those of man, no authority can make them act virtuously. They may be convenient slaves, but slavery will have its constant effect, degrading the master and abjecting the dependent. If you're going to exclude women without consulting them from sharing in the natural rights of mankind, then defend yourself against the accusations of injustice and inconsistency by proving that women do not have reason. I think that is really, I don't think it could be said any better.
Yeah.
That women deserve a right, and that includes all of us, even those who are not biologically a woman, but decided to be one or felt that they were all along. I'm not going to go into the debate on the science of it. I think there is something scientific there. And it is, you're born that way. I totally believe that Lady Gaga's song is right. You're born the way you are, and you can't help the way you are. And we should just reach out our hand and lift you up. That's just, I feel very strongly about it. So,
well, absolutely. I'm right with you. You were born the way you are. There is nothing wrong with you. You are who you are.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So I think to sum up our conversation on women in literacy, let's sort of just circle around to the main points that we're trying to make here, that women's literature really is essential to life, because when you look at how it was broken down and brought back up, the reason that we are here is because of the fact that, you know, women need to be here. Our voice needs to be heard. And that's what we're going to try to do. And I will ask the ladies here to kind of contribute their last thoughts on the issue of women in literature. And if there's anything else you want to sort of throw into the pot here.
No, I think I've touched on all the things that I wanted to touch on.
Again, just to reiterate, all women have a right to a voice, and whether that be written or spoken.
And
exactly.
Whether or not we agree with it. I think that's always an important part, is even if something that is written is very controversial, you know, and like I said, it could be even that, you know, the group of women that don't think we deserve to vote. It's still important for that to be out in the world and for their voice to be heard, whether or not we agree with it.
Because that creates constructive debate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need to get back to a place where we can have constructive debate. You know, we kind of miss that. And I would, well, you know, it's funny. I'll probably say this and probably get hit for it, but whatever. I would actually welcome a debate with a conservative woman. Like, bring it on. I'm more than willing to discuss things with you in a very respectful manner. I am sure I have many counterpoints to what you're saying, but I still would let you speak. And I wouldn't try to silence you just because your views are different than mine.
Right.
I think it's important to all stick it together. We are still one species, and we kind of need to fight for each other.
We're all on this rock together. We might as well get along.
Exactly. That's, I think, the point. And so all month long, we really encourage all of you to keep visiting our website as we showcase some of our female authors. We also are really, really excited because we're getting really close to releasing Maria Kjeldehags, or Kulvig. I always spell her, pronounce her name wrong because I'm horrible with Norwegian names. But Maria's book, The Seed of Yggdrasil, is coming really soon, and we're so excited about it. I cannot wait. If you want to hear a woman's perspective on the myths, she is your girl. She is an extensive researcher of Norse mythology. She is an amazing woman who has a voice that really cannot be silenced. She's strong, independent, and extremely smart. So please check out her website at thebladehorner.wordpress.com. We have the links on our website, and check out all of her articles on archaeology, Norse mythology, and more right before her book comes out. So we encourage you all to keep checking out our website and encourage you to keep visiting us on Facebook and Twitter. That's all for this episode of Nevermore Come Podcast. Please visit us at www.littlesisters.com. And that's it for this one. We'll see you on the next.